I have nothing new to teach the world. Truth and non-violence are as old as the hills. All I have done is to try experiments in both on as vast a scale as I could. In doing so, I have sometimes erred and learnt by my errors. Life and its problems have thus become to me so many experiments in the practice of truth and non-violence. Well, all my philosophy, if it may be called by that pretentious name, is contained in what I have said. But you will not call it Gandhiism. There is no ism about it, and no elaborate literature or propaganda is needed about it. The scriptures have been quoted against my position, but I have held faster than ever to my position that truth may not be sacrificed for anything whatsoever. Those who believe in the simple truths I have laid down can propagate them only by living them. I have not the shadow of a doubt that any man or woman can achieve what I have if he or she would make the same effort and cultivate the same hope and faith. Come from physical capacity, it comes from an indomitable will. It is because we have at the present moment everybody claiming the right of conscience without going through any discipline whatsoever that there is so much untruth being delivered to a bewildered world. I have learned through bitter experience the one supreme lesson: to conserve my anger, and as heat conserved is transmuted into energy, even so our anger controlled can be transmuted into a power which can move the world. Joy lies in the fight, in the attempt, in the suffering involved, not in the victory itself. Life is greater than all art. I would go even further and declare that the man whose life comes nearest to perfection is the greatest artist. For what is art without the sure foundation and framework of a noble life? Literary education should follow the education of the hand, the one gift that visibly distinguishes man from the beast. It is a superstition to think that the fullest development of man is impossible without a knowledge of the art of reading and writing. That knowledge undoubtedly adds grace to life, but is in no way indispensable for man's moral, physical, or material growth. To forget how to dig the earth and tend the soil is to forget ourselves. The music of life is in danger of being lost in the music of the voice. Don't be dazzled by the splendor that comes to you from the west. Do not be thrown off your feet by this passing show. The enlightened one has told you in never-to-be-forgotten words, that this little span of life is but a passing shadow, a fleeting thing. And if you realize the nothingness of all that appears before your eyes, the nothingness of this material case that we see before us, ever-changing, then indeed there are treasures for you up above, and there is peace for you down here, peace which passeth all understanding, and happiness to which we are utter strangers. It requires an amazing faith, a divine faith, and surrender of all that we see before us. God alone is the judge of true greatness because he knows men's hearts. The distinguishing characteristic of modern civilization is an indefinite multiplicity of human wants. The characteristic of ancient civilization is an imperative restriction upon and a strict regulating of these wants. The golden rule is resolutely to refuse to have what millions cannot. This ability to refuse will not descend upon us all of a sudden. The first thing is to cultivate the mental attitude that will not have possessions or facilities denied to millions, and the next immediate thing is to rearrange our lives as fast as possible in accordance with that mentality. This is the unmistakable teaching of the Gita. He who gives up action falls. He who gives up only the reward rises. But renunciation of fruit in no way means indifference to the result. In regard to every action, one must know the result that is expected to follow, the means thereto, and the capacity for it. He who, being thus equipped, is without desire for the result, and yet is wholly engrossed in the due fulfillment of the task before him, is said to have renounced the fruits of his action. Love is the subtlest force in the world. All your scholarship, all your study of Shakespeare and Wordsworth would be in vain if at the same time you did not build your character and attain mastery over your thoughts and your actions. The only tyrant I accept in this world is the still small voice within. Does not the history of the world show that there would have been no romance in life if there had been no risks? The wife is not the husband's bond slave, but his companion and his helpmate and an equal partner in all his joys and sorrows, as free as the husband to choose her own path. Absolute calm is not the law of the ocean, and it is the same with the ocean of life. Chastity is one of the greatest disciplines without which the mind cannot attain requisite firmness. To a true artist, only that face is beautiful which, quite apart from its exterior, shines with the truth within the soul. Democracy, disciplined and enlightened, is the finest thing in the world. My notion of democracy is that under it, the weakest should have the same opportunity as the strongest. The spirit of democracy cannot be established in the midst of terrorism, whether governmental or popular. In my humble opinion, non-cooperation with evil is as much a duty as is cooperation with good. Little do town dwellers know how the semi-starved masses of India are slowly sinking into lifelessness. Little do they know that their miserable comfort represents the brokerage they get for the work they do for the foreign exploiter, that the profits and the brokerage are sucked from the masses. Little do they realize that the government, established by law in British India, is carried on for this exploitation of the masses. Machinery, to be well used, has to help and ease human effort. The present use of machinery tends more and more to concentrate wealth in the hands of a few, in total disregard of millions of men and women whose bread is snatched by it out of their mouths. I claim for the charkha, the spinning wheel, the honor of being able to solve the problem of economic distress in a most natural, simple, inexpensive, and business-like manner. The charkha, therefore, is not only not useless, but is a useful and indispensable article for every home. It is the symbol of a nation's prosperity, and therefore freedom. It is a symbol not of commercial war, but of commercial peace. The spinning wheel means national consciousness and a contribution by every individual to a definite, constructive, national work. It was our love of foreign cloth that ousted the spinning wheel from its position of dignity. Therefore, real planning consisted in the best utilization of the whole manpower of India and the distribution of the raw products of India in her numerous villages, instead of sending them outside and rebuying finished articles at fabulous prices. A true and non-violent combination of labor would act like a magnet, attracting to it all the needed capital. Capitalists would then exist only as trustees. When that happy day dawned, there would be no difference between capital and labor. Those who labor will have ample food, good and sanitary dwellings, all the necessary education for their children, ample leisure for self-education and proper medical assistance. As I look at Russia, where the apotheosis of industrialization has been reached, the life there does not appeal to me. To use the language of the Bible, what shall it avail a man if he gain the whole world and lose his soul? In modern terms, it is beneath human dignity to lose one's individuality and become a mere cog in the machine. I want every individual to become a full-blooded, fully developed member of society. Political power means capacity to regulate national life through national representatives. If national life becomes so perfect as to become self-regulated, representation becomes unnecessary. There is then a state of enlightened anarchy. In such a state, everyone is his own ruler. He rules himself in such a manner that he is never a hindrance to his neighbor. In the ideal state, therefore, there is no political power because there is no state. But the ideal is never fully realized in life. Hence the classical statement of Thoreau that government is best which governs least. Government of the people, by the people, and for the people cannot be conducted at the bidding of one man, however great he may be. Liberty never meant the license to do anything at will. In mass civil resistance, leadership is essential. In individual civil resistance, every resistor is his own leader. Non-violence and cowardice go ill together. I can imagine a fully armed man to be at heart a coward. Possession of arms implies an element of fear, if not cowardice. But true non-violence is an impossibility without the possession of unadulterated fearlessness. It is the acid test of non-violence that in a non-violent conflict there is no rancor left behind, and in the end, the enemies are converted into friends. That was my experience in South Africa with General Smuts. He started with being my bitterest opponent and critic. Today, he's my warmest friend. This is, in essence, the principle of non-violent non-cooperation. It follows, therefore, that it must have its root in love. Its object should not be to punish the opponent or to inflict injury upon him. Even while non-cooperating with him, we must make him feel that in us he has a friend, and we should try and reach his heart by rendering him humanitarian service wherever possible. That is the beauty of satyagraha. It comes up to oneself. One has not to go out in search for it. Truth, satya, implies love, and firmness, agraha, engenders and therefore serves as a synonym for force. I thus began to call the Indian movement satyagraha, that is to say, the force which is born of truth and love, or non-violence. Ahimsa is the attribute of the soul, and therefore to be practiced by everybody in all the affairs of life. If it cannot be practiced in all departments, it has no practical value. Ahimsa is not the crude thing it has been made to appear. Not to hurt any living thing is no doubt a part of ahimsa, but it is its least expression. The principle of ahimsa is hurt by every evil thought, by undue haste, by lying, by hatred, by wishing ill to anybody. It is also violated by our holding on to what the world needs. Ahimsa and truth are so intertwined that it is practically impossible to disentangle and separate them. They're like the two sides of a coin, or rather a smooth, unstamped metallic disc. Who can say which is the obverse and which the reverse? Nevertheless, ahimsa is the means, truth is the end. Non-violence in its dynamic condition means conscious suffering. It does not mean meek submission to the will of the evildoer, but it means the pitting of one's whole soul against the will of the tyrant. Working under this law of our being, it is possible for a single individual to defy the whole might of an unjust empire, to save his honor, his religion, his soul, and lay the foundation for that empire's fall or its regeneration. And so I am not pleading for India to practice nonviolence because she is weak. I want her to practice nonviolence being conscious of her strength and power. No training in arms is required for realization of her strength. The force generated by nonviolence is infinitely greater than the force of all the arms invented by man's ingenuity. Disobedience, to be civil, has to be open and nonviolent. Civil disobedience is the inherent right of the citizen. He dare not give it up without ceasing to be a man. Civil disobedience is never followed by anarchy. Criminal disobedience can lead to it. Every state puts down criminal disobedience by force. It perishes if it does not. But to put down civil disobedience is to attempt to imprison conscience. Nonviolence succeeds only when we have a real living faith in God. We must then evolve order out of chaos. And I have no doubt that the best and speediest method is to introduce the people's law instead of mob law. One great stumbling block is that we have neglected music. Music means rhythm, order. Its effect is electrical. It immediately soothes. I have seen in European countries a resourceful superintendent of police by starting a popular song control the mischievous tendencies of mobs. Unfortunately, like our Shastras, music has been the prerogative of the few, either the barter of prostitutes or high-class religious devotees. It has never become nationalized in the modern sense. If I had any influence with volunteer Boy Scouts and other organizations, I would make compulsory a proper singing in company of national songs. And to that end, I should have great musicians attending every congress or conference and teaching mass music. When a man submits to another through fear, he does not follow his nature, but yields to brute force. He who has no desire to dominate others by brute force will not himself submit to such force either. Recognizing, therefore, that man who fears brute force has not attained self-knowledge at all, our Shastras allowed him the use of brute force while he remains in this state. Forgiveness is the virtue of the brave. He alone who is strong enough to avenge a wrong knows how to love and forgive. He alone who is capable of enjoying pleasures can qualify to be a brahmachari by restraining his desires. There is no question of the mouse forgiving the cat. It will be evidence of India's soul force only if she refuses to fight when she has the strength to do so. It is necessary to understand what the phrase strength to fight means in this context. It does not mean only physical strength. Everyone who has courage in him can have the strength to fight, and everyone who has given up fear of death has such strength. We have to make truth and non-violence not matters for mere individual practice, but for practice by groups and communities and nations. That, at any rate, is my dream. I shall live and die in trying to realize it. My faith helps me to discover new truths every day.